You're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. I'm Kate Andrews, Associate Director at the IEA. On this week's episode, the IEA's Head of Education, Dr. Steve Davies, walks us through a relatively new theory called the foundational economy. This theory puts economic emphasis on material infrastructures in society, things like the water and sewer industries, and argues that systems of provision have been undermined in the age of privatization and outsourcing. Steve discusses the theory of the foundational economy, notes areas of support and criticism, and highlights questions that arise from the theory. Is the British economy too London-centric? Have our politicians overlooked foundations of economic life and their importance? And should these services be delivered by the state? If you like what you hear, subscribe to our iTunes channel, IEA Conversations.
Steve, thanks for joining me today. I'm going to ask you about the foundational economy, and this is an exciting podcast because I think this is the first time. Well, you've educated me on quite a lot over the years, Steve. This is the first time I'm asking about something where I have absolutely no idea what the topic is or what the definition is of it. So can you please tell me and our listeners what the foundational economy is?
Well, this is actually an idea that I only came across relatively recently. It's an idea that's been developed over the last few years by a group of researchers based at various places around the world, but primarily at the University of Manchester, near to where I actually live. And it's been trotted out in a series of papers, a series of research events, and more recently in a book with the title The Foundational Economy. So what is the idea? Well, the idea essentially is that a large part of the economy consists of what they call foundational activities. These are the activities, the products, the services, the goods, which are necessary for all the rest of the economy to work. They're foundational in that sense. This means certain obvious things like public infrastructure, telephones and broadcasting, electrical supply, gas supply, water mains, drains, all that kind of thing. But it also means, in a larger term, the various kinds of services and functions that enable the rest of society to work, such as the educational system, for example. The point about this kind of economy is that it has a number of distinctive features. One of them is that if these services are provided on a commercial basis, as they often have been historically and even now, they typically make a stable but modest return. You're talking about like 4-5% return, basically. That's because these are very safe products and services, in the sense that the demand for them is constant and persistent. It's counter-cyclical, in other words, acyclical. It doesn't fluctuate very much with the business cycle. Not going to decline dramatically, because people are always going to want to drink water. They're always going to need core goods of this kind. So it's therefore a very safe investment. But on the other hand, also, it's an area where historically innovation has been relatively limited in recent years. There was at one point in time a lot of innovation in this area back in the 19th century, but not much recently. So hence, low returns. So that's the first feature it has. The second feature it has is that this is a sector of the economy that is almost entirely domestic. It's not at all exposed to international competition. Typically, both the production and the demand side of this are highly localized. In the 19th and early 20th century, localized at the level typically of the local authority, in fact. Most of these foundational economic services, things like tramways, waterworks, gasworks, all this public infrastructure, was provided by local authorities, municipal councils of one kind and another, county councils. It's been taken over by the national state in the middle of the 20th century. But even so, it's not been at all made transnational in the way that a large part of the consumer economy has, for example. So if you buy almost any consumer good, you're talking about something which, in terms of both the financing of it and the actual supply chains that have gone to create it, is organised and structured typically on a transnational cross-border basis, whereas that's not true for the transnational economy. And the third thing about it is that it's typically rather labour-intensive. It employs a very large number of people. And again, that employment is relatively stable. Now, the main argument made by the authors of the book and the various papers is that this part of the economy has been overlooked and not thought of as a kind of discrete sector or part of the economy, mainly because they think of what they regard as an excessive focus by politicians, policymakers, academics on the kind of cutting-edge, high-technology, knowledge-intensive products and services, KIPS as they're known by the acronym. And the argument they make, which I think is well taken, is that those kinds of sectors, which attract a lot of effort to try and get investment, they're seen as the great saviours of economic growth. While they do indeed lead to economic growth, they don't do much in terms of, for example, creating employment. So if you have a bunch of high-tech, high knowledge incorporating products in a place like Oxford or Manchester associated with the university there, it creates a relatively small number of highly skilled and highly paid jobs. It doesn't have any major impact on incomes or employment for the bulk of the population there. Whereas this other sector, which is generally overlooked or taken for granted, actually provides the bulk of the employment, the income for large numbers of people, particularly in the older industrial areas, the parts of the world economy that are not plugged into the knowledge-intensive sector in the way that, say, Greater London is.
I guess when assessing this, some of it could be factual. I mean, is it the case that this sector of the economy is employing as many people as they claim? Yeah. Is it the case that they are providing all those jobs?
Yes, absolutely. That's straightforwardly a matter of identifying certain sectors as, or activities rather, as being in that sector, and then just simply totting up how many people work in the identified areas. And what is very striking if you look at various regions of the United Kingdom is to see how in London this sector is very much a minor employer, whereas when you go to somewhere like Liverpool, Newcastle-on-Tyne, South Yorkshire, it's by far the largest part of the local economy in terms of both activity and employment. So there are very, very pronounced regional variations.
And so this theory feeds into other ideas about another areas of the UK that essentially aren't London being neglected by politicians. Yes. And thinkers and the like.
Yes, precisely. The argument is essentially, firstly, that the politicians have simply overlooked, not so much ignored, just overlooked and literally not recognised or seen this large part of economic life and its importance. It also includes, by the way, domestic economic activity, the kind of enormous part of the economy which takes place unpaid within the home and the household, which again the economists and the regulators and the politicians pretty much ignore mostly. So it's been overlooked by the politicians and the regulators. But also the argument is that to the extent that there are policies for regeneration or recovery in places like the northwest of England or Tyneside and Wearside, these tend to focus on the idea that they'll be rescued by high technology intensive jobs. Now, there's nothing wrong with those, of course, and you do want to have jobs like that, and they're very important. But the argument is that by themselves, they're not going to transform the economies of areas that are so fundamentally built around and dependent upon this foundational sector. So that's the basic argument.
So give me your analysis, Steve, of the foundational economy theory. What's good about it?
Well, the first thing is, one of the things I like about it is that this is actually a historical perspective on the modern economy. And I like that, being a historian. It actually comes not so much from economic thinking, but from the work of a French historian called Fernand Braudel. Many years ago, Braudel wrote an enormous book, his magnum opus, really, called Material Civilization and Capitalism. It was in three huge volumes. And in the first volume, he looked at what he called the structure of everyday life. And this was the part of economic life in the pre-modern period which typically didn't involve money and was located in the home. It was the domestic sphere. The other two sectors that he looked at were, first of all, the market sector, market-traded goods and products, and thirdly, what he called the capitalist sector, by which he meant what was at that time a pretty small sector consisting of long-distance trade, a certain number of merchants, and speculative financial capital. Now, that's where the basic idea comes from. I think actually that the authors could do with tweaking it slightly, because I think what has actually happened in the modern world is that the Braudel's idea of the domestic economy has now split into two. There's the continuing domestic sector, and then there's this foundational sector that these authors have identified, which is essentially commercial, very often, but it has the qualities I mentioned earlier. It's not part of the... It's still different and distinct, I think, from the mainstream, market-driven process of production, distribution, manufacture, such as retail, for example, because that sector is subject to much more dramatic fluctuations, innovations, changes in patterns of demand and production and the like. And then finally, of course, it's obviously very distinct from the final sector, Brodel's capitalist sector, the sector of transnational finance, very high-tech industry, the very kind of footloose corporations like Google and Apple and the like that everyone's trying to attract these days. So that's one good thing about it. It has a kind of historical aspect to it. Another good thing about it, I think, is that it does genuinely identify an area of economic life and of policy which has been simply ignored. If you think about, for example, poverty policy, one of the obvious implications of this whole way of thinking is that one of the things that you need to do in order to address poverty is to address things like the basic cost of living, the cost of everyday life, the cost of fundamental services that everyone depends on and has no choice about consuming, such as, most notably, housing. So it fits in very well, for example, with the two monographs that Christian Nemitz did for the IEA a few years ago about defining and thinking about poverty. There's a very close fit, I think, between this analysis and Christian's proposed alternative way of thinking about anti-poverty policy and how to go about it. And it does lead us, I think, to recognise that a lot of the policies that and focuses of current policy are not so much misguided as simply perhaps aiming at the wrong part of the target and missing a large part of what is going on. So that's what's good about it. I think it brings all kinds of insights. On the other hand, I also have serious problems with it as it's currently formulated.
Well, I'm going to ask you about those very quickly for listeners at home. You can download Christian's books on poverty and all other IEA publications on our website, iea.org.uk. Steve, I could sense a butt coming on. I could sense that there was going to be some critical analysis. So why don't you dig in?
Well, I think partly my critical view comes not so much from the basic idea itself as from the agenda and orientation of the scholars involved in this, because they're coming essentially from a radical social democratic left perspective. And one of the assumptions, which to be fair to them, they do qualify, but it still underlies a lot of what they say, is that most of this foundational sector should be provided by government, whether local or national. They tend to think it needs to go back to being more local, but they still think it should be government that does it. I think that's not necessarily the case. You can recognise the existence of this sector, but not necessarily assume that it has to be or should be provided purely or even primarily by government and through the political process. The obvious case would be a lot of infrastructure, such as railways, historically provided highly successfully by the private sector in both the United Kingdom and North America. Similarly, other functions like gas and water, for example, provided sometimes by local government and the state, provided on other occasions by private entrepreneurs. It makes sense, I think, to have probably a lot of experimentation in this sector and a mixed economy at the very least, in which there's a significant role for the private sector. So I'm put off slightly by the argument that there's a kind of natural fit between this foundational part of the economy and provision of these services by government. I don't think that follows at all. And there are obvious significant problems in some cases with having the state provide this, not least the lack of innovation that tends to come along with that, and the problem of capture of the process by typically employees, both managerial and manual. So that's one objection I have to it. That's an objection more to the sort of way that the angle, if you like, or the tack that the authors are taking rather than to the idea itself. A more profound problem I have with it is that it tends to be extremely hostile, I think, to the role that charging and market exchange and prices can play in making this part of the economy work more effectively and be more responsive. A large part of the book, Foundational Economy, which I alluded to at the start, is concerned with what they see as the very bad effects of the outsourcing revolution. And I have to say a lot of the detailed criticism is on point and well taken. But the argument is that there's something inherently and necessarily wrong with the process of bringing in private sector suppliers or providers to this sector, and in particular to the whole process of outsourcing of various kinds of functions, such as refuse collection, to take just one of many examples, by local authorities and by local government. And it seems to me that actually on their own account, the real problem is rather with the investment model of the private providers who've come in, and in particular an investment model which demands a very high rate of return, 10 to 15% typically, which these kinds of activities simply can't provide. Now, there is an alternative free market approach, which Arthur Seldon at the IEA was very much associated with, as I remember vividly myself, during the time he was there, which was that local authorities in particular should actually raise a lot of their income by charging for their services. In other words, they should actually run them on a commercial basis. Now, that's not the same thing as outsourcing it, because whether the services in question are provided either by local authorities or by some kind of corporate club body, which I think is the other major non-government alternative we have here, the use of charging as a way of funding these services means that you're much more responsive to the public, to the customer and the end user, because the degree to which they use the service and pay the fees, the charges, will send all sorts of signals about what they want and what they don't want. And in turns, it means that therefore the providers, whether they're governmental or not, will be more responsive to the needs of the consumers who are paying the charges. The problem at the moment, I think, is that the providers are mainly responsive to the needs and demands of their investors, rather than the consumers, because the consumers are still not paying directly, they're paying indirectly through tax, and the therefore the people that the providers mainly respond to now and whose interests they're mainly worried about are the investors, who, as I say, are looking for what I think is probably an excessive rate of return. So I think that reflects a kind of fundamental weakness in the model as it is at the moment, but it's not an inherent weakness. It's just that I think they've come in with a model of commercial and private on the one hand, or largely non-commercial, even if it involves like flat rate charging or something on the other side. And what I don't think they've done is been a bit imaginative enough to think there's actually this whole other way of dealing with the financing of this foundational economy, which could make much more use of charging and market relations.
Fascinating stuff, Steve. I guess I'd also point out that I think that some of these foundational economy areas are given attention by politicians, especially when they want to talk about nationalizing them. So, well, yes. You know, it is brought up, but as you say, in very strict terms.
Yes. And I think also just crucially, it's not seen as a sector in its own right. That's one of the points that is made, which I think does bear emphasis, which is that essentially most economic analysis thinks of the private sector as a kind of single undifferentiated lump. And similarly, the public sector is often thought of in that way. And actually, in some ways, it makes more sense to think of the degree to which the activities that are carried on are essential, foundational, acyclical, or subject to quite marked fluctuations, which would make much more sense in some ways. There's obviously a kind of overlapping indeterminate area in the middle, which they recognise actually in the book. They call it the overlooked sector, which I think is unfortunate, but never mind, that's their own particular terminology. So there is obviously a kind of overlap between the two, but I think it is actually helpful to distinguish between the part of the economy that's much more subject to changes in fashion, changes in consumer demand, changes in patterns of investment, that's much more dynamic in a way. And that part of it which is very important and essential for the rest of it, but which is not subject to the same levels of innovative disruption that the rest of the economy is.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for that. Some new economic jargon that we can add to the dictionary. And for listeners at home, if you hear anybody else talk about the foundational economy, they might also listen to the IEA podcast. Steve, thank you.
Thank you.
For more blogs, podcasts, films, and reports, visit our website at iea.org.uk.